This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've long since become accustomed to DNA evidence in rape and murder cases. Now, many crime labs are turning to those interlocking strands to investigate nonviolent crimes. The New York City Medical Examiner's Office intends to set up a shop to test material from crime scenes that involve burglary and car theft, in part to gain useful information and in part to follow former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's broken windows theory of crime. Vigorous prosecution of smaller infractions helped to reduce crime overall. Key to all of this is to collect DNA from new sources beyond blood and semen and to test it quickly and accurately. Later in the program, new rules on what can and can't be called a Neapolitan pizza. We'll talk about the prospect of pizza police with Peter Sagal, but first the pros and cons of expanded DNA testing. If you have questions about how DNA evidence can be used and the potential problems of genetic fingerprints, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Robert Shaler, Director of Forensic Biology Department of the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. He joins us on the phone from Flemington, New Jersey, and thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Collecting low-copy DNA is the method described for new sources of DNA samples. For those of us who aren't experts, please explain what low-copy DNA is.
Well, low-copy DNA testing refers to the finding and isolation of very, very small numbers of cells on evidence that is found at crime scenes. And this type of evidence is typically fingerprints, which are left at the scene by a burglar, for example. It could be DNA that's found on a keyboard in a computer or on a doorknob.
So smaller amounts of material than we're accustomed to using.
That's absolutely correct. And also, because it's smaller, you have to be really concerned about the environment in which you analyze the DNA. And so the laboratory that we're setting up has specifically been designed to minimize or eliminate all kinds of contamination that would occur during the analysis process.
And during the collection process as well.
Absolutely. And this is a huge training mission that we have, is to train the New York City Police Department to collect this evidence so that there is no cross-contamination.
Why did your office decide to use this method for nonviolent crimes?
Well, we've known for a long time that people who commit burglaries progress on to other kinds of crimes. The recidivist rate of burglars is in the neighborhood of about 50%. So the thought would be that if we could identify who these people are, we might prevent them from doing something more violent, such as a rape or a murder, and get them off the streets.
I wonder, I've read that the use of DNA evidence in the World Trade Center investigation influenced, certainly your expertise in the use of DNA?
Well, yes, and a number of the samples that we received from the World Trade Center were very much limited in the amount of usable DNA that was present in them. So we got a lot of experience in analyzing what really was low-copy number DNA.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to create a vast amount of data to store. What's involved in that?
Well, it's a huge amount of data. We're looking to do about 400,000 samples a year, which means we're going to have to get all these DNA profiles into a database.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you should also understand that just because we're going to do 400,000 samples a year doesn't mean we're going to have 400,000 profiles. The vast majority of these profiles will probably not be useful because we will not, just because of the amount of DNA that's present, probably won't yield DNA profiles. But there will be a percentage of them that will. And we may get as many as 40,000 profiles we have to put into a DNA databank.
But that also implies that you're going to be doing a lot more testing than you ever have before.
That's absolutely right, which means, to do that, we're setting up a fully automated laboratory to do the testing.
Now, this means handling partial DNA evidence. Is it handled differently than a vial of blood or semen, for example?
Well, yes, it is. Yes and no. I mean, the process of extracting the DNA is the same. It's just done on a robot. The collection of the sample is done a little differently to make sure, because you have to make sure you're very efficient at collecting the sample because you want to get it all. But the process is basically the same. It's just that we do it with a little more care.
is in using low copy DNA, is there a greater possibility of making a mistake?
Well, not really. You have a DNA profile, and we believe we have the expertise to interpret those profiles. The mistake would occur during the interpretation process.
During interpretation. So the hugely increased volume of testing and interpretation, does that create the possibility of mistakes?
Well, I don't think so. We're setting up a laboratory so that won't happen. A lot of this will be done using electronics, and we're specifically tailoring computer software to help us do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if one person sat there and looked at 400,000 DNA profiles, they certainly would be making mistakes, but that's not what's going to happen.
I assume there was some cost-benefit analysis that went into all of this. It's not going to be, by any means, the cost of this is not going to be negligible.
Well, it's going to be expensive, but compared to normal DNA testing done on homicides and rapes, it's actually fairly inexpensive.
Give us some numbers.
I think it's costing us about $35 million. It will be costing us about $35 million to do casework analysis, and this is about $4.4 million.
Our number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN@npr.org. And we've got a call from Long Island in New York. Jerry joins us.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I listen to your program regularly, and I really, it's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
One of the comments I have some extensive background in molecular biology and developmental biology. I found DNA profiling, I think, is a fantastic tool, and I can't agree with you more that people who are committing nonviolent crimes may potentially go ahead and commit violent crimes. I do, however, question the use of funds for such a thing when, I think previously it was on this program, I'd heard that there's such a tremendous backlog of rape kits that we don't have the funding to test at present.
Robert Shaler?
Well, New York City does not have a backlog of rape kits. We embarked on a program a few years ago to get rid of the New York City Police Department's backlog, and we did 16,000 rape kits, and that program is finished now. So we do not have a backlog in homicide cases or rape kits in the city of New York.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that. That's really fantastic. No, thank you. And good luck with all the work that you're doing. I really hope it works out for you the way you've planned.
Jerry, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And one final question before we let you go, Robert Shaler. In the process of doing this, you're going to be, there's going to be a vast databank of DNA profiles of every year, thousands and thousands more New Yorkers in this particular case. Does that cause you any kind of pause?
That the fact that we're going to have criminals' DNA profiles in a databank doesn't bother me at all. I think it's a good place for them.
Suspected criminals' databank in a DNA in a databank, too.
Absolutely. Suspected criminals. That's absolutely right.
Right. People haven't been convicted.
That's absolutely true.
No problems.
I don't think it's a problem because this is something which has been left at a crime scene. And when it's left, it's certainly fair game to pick it up and analyze it.
Robert Shaler, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Robert Shaler joined us on the phone from Flemington, New Jersey. He's the director of Forensic Biology Department of New York City's Medical Examiner's Office. And joining us now is Paul Ferrara. He's the director of the Virginia State Forensic Laboratory, and he joins us from his office in Richmond. His lab has long tested DNA samples at property crime scenes. So welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
I wonder if you have any advice for Mr. Shaler, who's just starting off collecting a low sample evidence or evidence for property crimes.
Well, Dr. Shaler doesn't really need any advice from us. He's very familiar with our program here in Virginia and has addressed the concerns that we all share with any type of low copy number DNA samples in terms of the potential for contamination and mixtures and such, and interpretation of those. However, he is correct that it really doesn't present any greater of a technical problem, just more care and consideration.
How long has your lab been collecting this kind of DNA?
We've been collecting samples from all convicted felons, including those convicted of property crimes, since 1990. We have now in Virginia a database of approximately 216,000 individuals.
And that's for people who are convicted. What about for those who are arrested?
we have approximately 10,000 DNA profiles of persons arrested for violent crime. That program started in January of 2003 and has already resulted in almost 100 hits just from the arrestee database.
And how many samples do you have in total in your database now?
Some 216,000.
How often do you match new evidence with samples from the database?
We average about 3 to 4 hits a day.
3 or 4 hits a day?
3 or 4 hits a day.
Huh. And I wonder, how does what you do in terms of collection compare to what the FBI or federal government collects?
Well, the federal government, the FBI, plays a key role in terms of combining all of the DNA databanks that the states run into a cohesive national system. So the profiles developed in New York State of convicted felons and crime scene evidence can be searched by officials in Virginia and vice versa.
Because sometimes criminals might move from state to state.
Yes, we have had something in the area of 130 interstate hits, you know, where we have matched crime scene evidence with convicted felons in other states or vice versa out of some 2,000 hits that we have achieved thus far.
Have you been able to keep up with all of the material you've collected in terms of, is there a backlog?
Yeah, we're building up a backlog. As you indicated earlier, we have been doing these property crimes essentially for 15 years, and it represents potentially a tremendous volume of evidence that can be submitted to our laboratory. Every time somebody breaks into a house, cuts themselves on a piece of glass, helps themselves to a bottle of beer in the refrigerator, or leaves some object, that creates an item of evidence. As police investigators, such as those in Virginia, have become very aware of the potential, they collect that evidence. And we are currently up to almost 2,000 cases that are backlogged in our laboratory, and that's the highest it's ever been.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Robert, who's with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
So should I ask my question now?
Yes, please.
Well, the gentleman who was speaking before this...
Mr. Shaler, yes.
Yes, he was talking. He said two things that I question. One is, he said, how do we know... He said that we've known for a long time that burglars move on to bigger crimes,
mm-hmm.
such as rapes or murders. How do we know that?
Can you address that, Paul Ferraro?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. One, there's been several studies over the last 2 decades on the recidivism rate among convicted felons. At least one study determined that of over 100,000 persons released, I think it was 1983, that within 3 years, 60% had been rearrested for similar or more violent crimes. We have also seen empirically here in Virginia this same trend of the violent crimes that we have solved with our DNA databank. The majority of those hits of violent crimes have come because we had the person who we identified was in our databank for a prior property crime.
Robert, I take it you had another point?
There's a question of
Robert,
functionality of the inference.
Robert, I'm going to have to ask you to stay on hold. Can you stay with us till after the break?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and if you could stay with us as well, Paul Ferraro?
Be glad to.
We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing solving and preventing crimes using DNA, not just violent crimes, but more and more often property crimes, nonviolent crimes as well. Of course, you're invited to join us. What questions do you have about these broader uses for DNA? Do you want to fact check how a TV show presented the use of DNA evidence? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Paul Ferrara. He's director of the Virginia State Forensic Laboratory. And Robert's on the line with us from Boulder, Colorado. You had another question.
Well, I actually had a second question I wanted to raise that was somewhat separate to this one, but in following up with what we were just talking about.
In terms of the proclivities of some people who are burglars to move on to more serious crimes, yes?
Well, I guess I have two concerns. One is I suspect that it would be quite erroneous to assume that because someone was charged with a burglary or convicted of it, that we could be certain that they would move on to bigger crimes.
Go ahead, Paul Ferrara.
Well, clearly we're not certain of that. It's just that the statistics and empirical evidence has shown that to be the case. What you have to keep in mind in this is many people who are convicted of property crimes, their original intent may not have been something as simple as a breaking and entering, but they cop a plea to a lesser charge. So that's playing into this as well. But it's the statistical likelihood that a person who has committed a nonviolent felony, it has a much greater likelihood of committing a violent crime down the road than someone who has not. That's all we're depending upon. We're isolating the population that's most likely to commit crime in the future.
Well, I guess I can't argue that there would be a greater likelihood of somebody who had committed one crime would be likely to commit another.
Mm-hmm. One of the things to keep in mind, too, when we talk about these DNA databanks that I think is important for the public to understand is that these DNA profiles are devoid of any genetic traits or medical conditions or the kind of information that might be misused by an insurance company or an employer. The DNA profiles that are used in these forensic databanks they come from non-coding regions of the DNA, which allow us to identify an individual to essentially the exclusion of all others, except for identical twins. But in doing so, the genetic locations that we use do not contain any of the genes that show one's predisposition for disease or certain traits.
Mm-hmm. Robert?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to move on.
Could I ask my second question?
Oh, if you keep it short, okay.
It had to do with error in measurement. Your prior expert on DNA testing said essentially that there would be no errors, and it seems to me that anyone who knows anything about measurement knows there's always an error, and so if you're doing a lot more tests, your total number of errors would increase even if your percent of errors remain the same.
Well,
I wondered what
go ahead, Robert. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Paul.
Yeah. Clearly, Robert, as in any human endeavor, we know that there are chances for error. Now, in our forensic laboratories, we go to great lengths to minimize those errors or be able to identify a problem when we encounter it. The question you asked of Dr. Shaler was, as you go to these smaller and smaller samples, is there a greater chance of error? And he answered, no, and he did so because you have a greater chance of coming up with perhaps an inconclusive result. But the forensic scientists who do these analyses go through many steps before they actually will call a DNA profile as belonging to an individual. If, as you get into some of these very small areas, you do get an increased likelihood of inconclusive results. When you get, when you're dealing with picogram quantities of the DNA, someone who's touched the steering wheel of a car, the prior owner maybe is will be mixed with the DNA of the person who stole that car and last used it. So when you get the DNA profile, you might see two profiles, and if they are there in approximately the same amounts, you come up with a confused result, and you won't report it unless you can clearly see one profile over the other. You know, I understand your concerns, but the technology is probably the most validated and reliable technology of all of the forensic sciences.
Well, I'm not really questioning the reliability or validity. I'm just saying that I think that there would be error, and it seemed like the prior saying there wouldn't be.
As he explained, I think it had to do with the imprecision of my question rather than than his answer. Robert, thanks very much for the
call. All right, thank you.
And Paul Ferrara, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Paul Ferrara directs the Virginia State Forensic Laboratory, and he was with us from his office in Richmond. With us now from his office in New York City is Lawrence Kobolinski. He's a professor of biology and immunology and associate provost of John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Good to have you with us.
Yes, Neil. Good to be with you.
How and when was DNA originally used as evidence in forensic science?
Well, although the methodology was developed in the mid-80s, it was first used in the United States in Florida in 1989. And what is interesting is that was a completely different kind of technology than what is used today. In fact, it's rather obsolete, and it's used only by a small number of labs, primarily doing paternity work. I think what we're doing today is far better. But I'd like to weigh in on this. I've listened very carefully to my good friend Bob Shaler and Paul Ferrara, and I think they're putting a very, very positive spin on this technology. I'd like to tell the audience that this is not a new technology. The British started this technology back in 1999. And in fact, the FBI has made a decision not to use it. It has been
this low copy DNA
5 years now, and the FBI has not used it. And I think the reason is that they consider this an unreliable technique. In order to get this kind of evidence into the courtroom, it has to be deemed admissible either through what is called a Frey hearing or through the Daubert at the federal level, so that there is a question about reliability of this testing. Let me explain exactly what I'm talking about. When you do this procedure of low copy number DNA, you have a series of issues that can really result in problems. Number one, you have something called allelic dropout, and number two, allelic drop-in. What that means is that when you type a particular genetic profile, you may see a genetic type on an individual that is inaccurate. In other words, a person who has two genes at a site called a locus, let's say, for example, a 15 and a 17, after doing low copy number, you may see only the 15. So you are going to get an incorrect profile. Sometimes you get a drop in, meaning that if somebody, let's say, normally would have a 14, in other words, this is a person who has a double dose of 14, you may all of a sudden see 14 mixed with a 13. And that's what we call allelic drop-in. So again, you get a false genetic type.
And how often does this happen?
Well, you know, that is a matter of low copy number technology. And the point is, this is what we call the result of a stochastic error. It's a matter of chance. It's a random event that occurs during the early stages of the amplification or copying of the DNA molecule. I can't give you a number, but it's a well-known artifact. There's also contamination. This technique is so sensitive that the analyst can contaminate the specimen. You can have mixtures. You can have samples that are old, that appeared at the crime scene weeks before, and suddenly they appear. And it is theoretically, it's possible for an older profile to appear while a newer, more recent profile, perhaps from the perpetrator, is not seen, so that you again can come to the wrong conclusion. And of course, Paul Ferrara just mentioned the secondary transfer, so that a burglar, for example, that shook hands with an innocent person may very well transfer that innocent person's DNA to the crime scene. So there are a lot of issues here that really put into question the reliability. And Neil, I thought your question about cost versus benefit is a very, very good one, because as Dr. Shayla said, only a fraction of the samples are going to provide a result. And of those have to be interpreted very carefully. Now, as for no error, there is no such thing as no error.
Right.
Where there are humans, there is error.
Let's get another caller involved in the conversation. Charles is with us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah, can it DNA evidence be brought into the crime scene after the fact as a frame?
Well, look, I mean, you hear this a lot. I do a lot of defense work, and there are many defendants that would claim that. You got to look for some evidence of that. Can it happen? It can under certain conditions. I think in the OJ case, there was an issue about tampering of the evidence. I can only say that it's possible, but possibilities, what does that mean? What's the probability? You have to look at an individual case to make that determination.
And presumably that's why there are detectives and investigators involved.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, let me tell you, you can do the same thing with fingerprints. You can lift a fingerprint and move it to another place. You can actually plant it at a crime scene. It's happened. So it can happen with DNA as well.
Charles, good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's an email question we got from Peter Wang, and this seems to go right to your point. I'm concerned that sources of low-copy DNA from crime scenes, such as doorknobs or fingerprints, is inherently more likely to give red herrings from sources such as blood and semen. How often have such sources given useful information leading to conviction?
Well, again, the only information that we have is from the British, and the British do claim that they have cleared a significant number of non-violent crime, you know, burglaries and that sort of thing. I don't have the statistics, but there's a good reason why the FBI has been very, very cautious in not adopting this technology.
We're speaking with Lawrence Kobolinski. He's professor of biology and immunology, associate provost of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he's with us from his office in New York City. And we're discussing the expanded use of DNA evidence and new kinds of DNA evidence, so-called low-copy DNA, being used in crime labs around the country in pursuit of nonviolent crimes often. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's bring Peter Neufeld into the discussion. He's director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School in New York City, and he joins us now from his office. And Peter Neufeld, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here, Neil.
As somebody who's relied on DNA evidence quite a bit, what do you think about these new ways of collecting DNA samples?
Well, actually, we've already worked on a case at the Innocence Project using low-copy DNA. So, look. The one thing you have to remember is that there's going to continue to be technological advances in the use and application of forensic DNA typing. On the one hand, I think that Larry is right, that you have to be cautious, you have to move slowly. On the other hand, I do think that the technology will improve to enable them to use low-copy DNA and get meaningful, reliable results. Are we at that magic point yet? I don't know. I do know that it has been used successfully in Great Britain. I do know there are a couple of people here who've been doing studies with it and have gotten very good results. That's the scientific method, and we'll see what happens. There are two problems, though, that haven't been considered. One is, you have to remember that with DNA, there's two issues. One is the identity of the profile of the source, and two, does it have anything to do with the crime? And you've already heard from other people that with secondary transfer or other sources, such as hair or fingerprints at a scene, you may get the DNA profile from that material, but it may have nothing to do with the commission of the crime. DNA has been most valuable for the last 15 years in sexual assault cases, where you're looking at semen, because there's only one way it gets there, Neil.
Mm-hmm.
But when you find a hair next to a bed, for instance, was it left by the perpetrator or was it left by the telephone repairman a week before? When you find fingerprints at a scene, does it have anything to do with the crime? You may get a DNA profile, you may identify that person, but he or she may have absolutely nothing to do with the crime, yet when someone's DNA is there, all of a sudden it's given some kind of mythical importance. So that's issue number one, which people have to consider very seriously. Issue number two, which I don't know if was addressed earlier because I wasn't on the line here, has to do with, because you get profiles from all these other sources, it becomes incumbent on law enforcement to do elimination profiles. And this is going to be a huge difference. Right now, for instance, you know, you're at a crime scene.
Elimination profiles means you want to get eliminate certain people who may have been at the scene.
Innocently.
Cops, for example.
Well, that's exactly right. So, for instance, you know, there's a burglary, and there is a piece of broken glass on the back door of the house. And you see a smudge, and so you swab it for DNA, and you get a profile. And then a week later, you arrest Neufeld because he's got the jewelry from the house in his car. And so you take my DNA, and you compare it to the DNA swab from that window, and I'm excluded. And so I say, hey, I didn't burglarize this place. You know, I found this property outside on the street.
And you certainly have a reasonable doubt to throw up.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
It could very well be that DNA on the window came from the first patrolman who arrived at the scene and saw the broken glass and put his hands on and said, aha, this is where the burglar must have gone in. And so what happens is you need to do elimination DNA profiles of other people, not just the people who live there, people who visited, but more importantly, all the police officers who are involved in the investigation. In Great Britain, where they're doing more of this nonviolent crime, low-copy DNA for property crimes, they have decided as a matter of principle that they need to have a database with DNA profiles of every single police officer in Great Britain. Needless to say, for a variety of civil rights concerns, the police don't want to be in that data bank. In New York City, which will be the first department in the country to be doing low-copy DNA testing on thousands of property crimes, if you speak to the experts, they will tell you without exception that we're going to need to have an elimination database of everybody in the NYPD. And I can't wait to see that confrontation between the scientists and the police union.
Peter Neufeld, can you stay with us?
Sure.
We're going to be back with Peter Neufeld and Lawrence Kobolinski and take more of your questions on this question of new uses of DNA and new kinds of crimes in which it's being used. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. We're also going to be talking about new rules on what is and what is not a pizza. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about collecting DNA from new sources. Coming up in just a few minutes, new rules on an old favorite, Neapolitan pizza. To join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us, our guests, Lawrence Kobolinski, professor of biology and immunology and associate provost of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Peter Neufeld, director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School in New York City. And let's get another caller on the line. John is with us from Minden, Nevada.
Hello.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a question I think has been partially answered. Is the profile completely digital, or is there a graphic component? And if it's digital, does that mean it can be, the matching can be done by computer?
Lawrence,
yes, I can address that. Yes, it is done by computer. The software is very sophisticated, and it takes a lot of the guessing out of the hands of the analyst, which is very good. You want this to be more of an objective measure rather than a subjective measure.
Thank you.
Okay, John, thanks very much for the call. And let's go now to John, and John's calling from Long Island in New York.
Yes, how are you?
Okay.
Well, first things first, I can't come up with words to describe how wonderful your show is. I know you hear it all the time, but I had to tell you that first things first.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, next. I went to a gun shop maybe a month ago, and I was looking at ammunition, and I had a lot of questions in reference to my gun and other guns, and I'm not going to get into that. But my point and why I'm calling is that I handled approximately two or three rounds that were shown to me and then put back in the box. Now, what if somebody buys that ammunition, robs a bank, or kills somebody? My DNA, my fingerprints are all over that. If I was a detective, I'd be looking for me. But my friend who's a cop says, you don't have to worry about it. And I said, well, explain yourself. And he's like, John, I don't have the time. And, you know, typical, that's my best friend.
Neil, if I can comment on that.
Go ahead.
My laboratory is right in the middle of a study looking exactly at this kind of a situation. We have a number of items, knives, guns, that have been handled. And what we've done is attempted to collect DNA off of those items to see if we can pick up the profiles using low copy number DNA. We don't have an answer yet, but I think it's very, very likely. And by the way, some people tend to leave DNA more readily than others. There are people that shed their cells with their fingerprints more readily than other people do.
Well, there's also another contributing factor, which is if a person puts his fingers in his mouth and then touches the object, then you're much more likely to leave a DNA print because you're getting the cells from the inside of your mouth.
Right.
Where they're much more plentiful than they are on your hand.
John, we're sure you never did such a thing.
Well, no, because I bite my nails. So now I'm feeling really great about this. But, I mean, honestly, what can happen? If there is a bank robbery, I would assume that the cops would pursue me if my fingerprints are on the shelves. I mean, am I right or am I wrong?
Well, I don't know about your fingerprints. I mean, certainly they pursued that lawyer in Portland because of fingerprints last week. And as you know, the FBI's digital enhancement of fingerprint system also didn't turn out to be quite as reliable.
Yep.
But getting back to the DNA as opposed to the fingerprints, yes. And that's the point I was making before, is that DNA can simply be used to identify the source of the biological material, but it doesn't answer the question, what relevance does it have to the commission of the crime?
Right, exactly. In other words, it proves that I was in contact with an element involved in the crime, but it doesn't prove that I committed the crime.
No, but unfortunately, when it comes to ammunition and a gun, that could be circumstantially a lot more probative than simply a smudge on a piece of glass outside someone's house that was burglarized.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why my friend one time who looked at my gun, it's a rifle, I handed it to him, he looked at it, he tested the scope and the sighting, he gave it back to me, then he's like, wait a second, and then he took it back and wiped it down. Now I know why he did that. Because, you know, I could walk into his house and kill everybody, and if I'm wearing gloves, his fingerprints are on the weapon.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know, so it's listen, once again, I love your show, and keep up the great work.
Oh, thanks, John. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our guests today. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Peter Neufeld is the director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School in New York City. He was with us from his office there. And Lawrence Kobolinski, professor of biology and immunology, associate provost of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he was also at his office in New York City.